So I'm Beth Reed. I just started a new position in the Berkeley Center for Cosmological Physics named Cosmology Data Science Fellow. I'm still trying to understand what exactly that might mean, but if there's a general theme to this talk, it will be progressively more aggressively trying to extract information from galaxy redshift surveys. This is my long list of collaborators, all of which are involved at some level in BOSS. Okay, so I'm going to start off by trying to give you a quick review of the physics that galaxy redshift surveys are sensitive to. I'll try to go fast through this part, but if you have any questions, please interrupt me. Then I'll talk about, we just put out a series of papers on our DataRe11 results, so I'll show you some of the highlights from those results. And then I want to talk about a project that I'm just now wrapping up, I've been fighting with for a year and a half, and that's studying redshift space distortions on very small scales. And then if I have time in the end, I'll talk a little bit about the next survey in that Berkeley is interested in working on, which is called DESI. Okay, so what is a galaxy redshift survey? It's conceptually really simple. So you get someone to go out and make an image of the sky. From that image, you select a list of target galaxies that are at the redshift range of interest or have the properties that you're interested in. From the imaging data, that will involve cuts on the magnitude of the objects and the colors of the objects. So now you have your list. You make a friend who will measure redshifts for you. Once you have those redshifts, you can make a three-dimensional map of the galaxy density field. All of the information that I'm going to talk about today will be extracted from that three-dimensional density field by measuring a correlation function or a power spectrum. Okay, so these are the measurements that I'm going to spend all day talking about. This is a measurement from BOSS of the correlation function. It's clearly not isotropic, it's a function of two variables. On the x-axis is the separation of a pair of galaxies transverse to the line of sight, and on the y-axis is their separation along the line of sight. This is the analogous plot. We actually haven't made one of these in BOSS, so this is from the Wigglesy survey, and this is the power spectrum. And you can see that the anisotropy is flipped in k-space compared to in real space. The other thing that your eyeball should pick out, if you can, I'll help you. And this is the baryon acoustic oscillation feature, and that's where we get a lot of the information that I'm going to talk about today. Okay, so there's a lot of physics involved in what determines these three-dimensional maps that we're making, and so I want to kind of put that in perspective and break it into three different parts that I'll talk about for a second. So this map is my attempt to put the observable universe on one figure. So here's the cosmic microwave background at a co-moving distance of 14 gigaparsecs. And here's the redshift survey in that scale to be the right size that we've done with BOSS. So the baryon acoustic oscillation that is really outstanding in the cosmic microwave background is about a degree physical size on the sky. So this black dot right here, if you can see it, is the physical scale of that feature. And it represents the distance that sound waves traveled in the early universe until recombination. That standard ruler has been exquisitely well calibrated by Planck, and its value is 151.4 plus or minus 0.66 megaparsecs. So we're going to look for that same feature in the distribution of galaxies. But the CMB doesn't just tell us about the BAO feature, it also gives us basically the initial conditions, the scale dependence of the initial power spectrum. And it measures that quite precisely. Just to flesh that out in a little bit more detail, here is a plot of the power spectrum from the Planck paper on relatively large multipoles. And this is the dark matter power spectrum, or the correlation function that we infer from looking at the cosmic microwave background. And the important point I want to make about this inference is that it depends on how much the physical density of cold dark matter and baryons and what the initial primordial perturbations look like. So these three parameters. But it doesn't depend on what happened in the universe after the cosmic microwave background. So we're not using information, for instance, the angular diameter distance to the CMB to make this inference. The power spectrum and the correlation function, although observers often plot the things that they measure in terms of H inverse megaparsec, these functions are determined really well in physical coordinates, megaparsecs. So here's the BAO feature and the correlation function. In the power spectrum, it looks like this faint series of wiggles that maybe you can see from where you're sitting. So this makes our life, knowing what the spectrum of fluctuations looks like, makes our analysis much easier. So I won't go into any more detail about that, except for to point out that the predicted power spectrum that we should see in matter is actually what we observe. This is the power spectrum analysis I did in 2000. Yes.
So are you saying that to actually do this BAO analysis, you have to assume that you know those cosmological parameters from the CMB?
No. Okay. So for BAO, the only thing we care about is basically, well, we do use a template that tells us kind of the shape of that feature looks like, but we marginalize over kind of the broadband structure of this function.
For example, if we change N and S, that would probably shift the position of the peak a little bit, right? Because it does.
Is that because you're marginalizing?
Right, so we marginalize any kind of broadband changes to the correlation function. So the physical scale that's induced by the BAO is it depends only on the physical densities, cold dark matter, and baryons. But all we really need to know is that it's there. So our interpretation of our observation of the BAO is, can be interpreted in a cosmological model in which the absolute distance scale depends on those parameters. All we need to know is that it exists.
Okay, but then, so you're saying you should assume that omega cold dark matter and omega baryons?
So when we interpret our measurement of the location, so basically, here's our template. We're gonna, this is anticipating a lot of the talk, but that's fine. So we have our measurements. We measure the location that the BAO shows up in our measurement of the correlation function relative to this template, and we interpret that location of the observed BAO as some distance measure to our galaxy sample in units of this standard ruler. And then the standard ruler does depend very, has a small dependence on these parameters.
So what you're saying is that for the interpretation of that plot, you need a 6-parameter cosmology?
No. I actually don't care what the shape of the power spectrum is if I'm just taking information from the BAO.
You said you need to assume a cosmology to get the position of the peak.
We do use a. We do generate a template that looks like the one that we think, the CMB tells us it should look like, but if we choose a different template and fit the BAO, I'm claiming that the thing that we're reporting, which is this distance scale divided by the BAO scale, is independent of the template that I use, as long as it's reasonable.
Is that the party line, right?
That is the party line, yes. It's not hard to test.
Are you guys asking about the issue of the redshift to real space map? Like, it's not clear to me what happens. This plot is after you convert redshift space to 3D space. And if you had, say, a wildly different if the cosmology was wildly different than the fiducial cosmology used to construct that mapping, it's not clear to me a priori what that does to the curve. Maybe that's what.
Well, you've come to the right talk, because I'm going to talk a lot about that. So let me just continue, and if things don't become clear, then ask more questions. Okay, so all I wanted to say here, the Planck papers actually had an error when they showed this plot. So this is our measurements from 2010 of the Sloan 2 LRG power spectrum, where we've done our best job of relating the observed galaxy power spectrum to the underlying dark matter halo power spectrum. And this is, given Planck's favorite cosmological parameters, this is the prediction for this power spectrum that you get, which is, you get a chi-square to 40.4. That's the number that was misreported in the Planck papers, compared to our best fit, which was 40. So really good agreement in just the general shape of this function. And that's all I'm going to say about that for now. Everything else, we just kind of doesn't actually depend on. We're not using information from the scale dependence of the power spectrum in our cosmological interpretation. That's a good question. I will have to run the numbers again. But we'll talk about that in the context of BOSS for sure. Okay, so the second piece of physics is that, as Kendrick anticipated, what we're measuring, we're making a map that's constructed from angular coordinates of our targets on the sky, and we're measuring a redshift. And when we, our theory, this is, our theory lives in physical megaparsec space. And so if we want to compare this map to this prediction, we need to convert these coordinates to co-moving distances. And that step, you can think of many ways of doing it, but practically what we do is we assume some fiducial cosmology that defines a redshift distance relationship, and that tells us how to map these coordinates into megaparsecs. And then if we want to know, well, what if the cosmology was different, we don't remeasure our correlation function in the new cosmology, but we construct our theory to say, what would I have measured if the cosmology, you know, if the BAO scale in this cosmology was at some much larger scale, but I know that I measured it with a certain cosmology. So that just, those basically just enter as scale factors on the two distances in that 2D correlation function plot that I showed you. And since Kendrick seems to be interested in this topic, I'll say one more thing, is that we're going to interpret all of our cosmology, so we're making a map that extends across a redshift range. But we're going to interpret things in terms of just one number and an effective redshift of the galaxy sample. And so if your redshift distance relationship were doing something really crazy, then that wouldn't be the right thing to do. Okay. So just to elucidate this, what we actually measured, so I've now already said this, but here's our standard ruler, the BAO feature. We're observing here, if we know this distance and we're able to measure the angular diameter distance by looking at pairs in the plane of the sky. That's the angular diameter distance. If we instead look for that ruler in pairs along the line of sight, then we measure the derivative of the angular diameter distance, which is 1 over the Hubble expansion rate at the redshift of the pair of the galaxies that we're looking at. The BAO has relatively low signal to noise, so what we usually do is average over all of the orientation of pairs of galaxies in the survey. And to a good approximation, that defines a distance measure that we call dV. So you have two parts angular diameter distance and one part 1 over h. And that's how we interpret an angle averaged fit to the BAO. And you end up with scale factors of the what the absolute distance is. That's written as RS here. So alpha is where the BAO feature shows up in our data relative to the model that we fit it with. And my claim is that if we fit it with a different model, we'll get a different value of alpha because this changes, but that will just be the ratio of the two fiducial cosmologies. Okay, but we have another piece of information, which is called the Alcock-Pachinski effect. So forget for a moment that we have a standard ruler at all. We can still compare the clustering of pairs transverse to the line of sight and along the line of sight. In the absence of any other sources of anisotropy, the clustering amplitude should be the same. And so that allows us to make a measurement of the ratio of distances transverse to the line of sight and along the line of sight. So I'll call that from now on the Alcock-Pachinski parameter, and it's just proportional to dA times h. Just to show you what that looks like, so here I am plotting a theory curve for the correlation function. I've taken out redshift space distortions for a minute. So all of these contours are circles if you use the correct cosmology when you made your mapping between angles and distances to megaparsecs. So if I alter the ratio between dA and h when I do that mapping, these circles now become ellipses. Okay, one more piece of physics that I'm interested in is gravity. So the cosmic microwave background gives us kind of an overall amplitude of matter fluctuations, or we can infer from the CMB an overall amplitude of matter fluctuations, and those fluctuations are enhanced by a factor of 1,000, roughly, as we go from redshift 1,000 to redshift 0. Okay, so how that's imprinted in our observables, the redshift that we observe is, you know, the redshift that indicates the distance to the object, plus a component that comes from the peculiar velocity of the object, so its motion and its local gravitational potential well. So naively, we're not able to separate the observed redshift into these two pieces. So when we make this 3D map, we just put the galaxy at whatever the observed redshift is. But that will have coherent distortions in the map that we make. Okay, so converting redshifts to distances, the inferred distance of a redshift is just its true distance plus the peculiar velocity divided by this scale factor, A times H. And on relatively large scales in linear theory, the peculiar velocities that enter here are simply related to the underlying matter fluctuations by this equation. So just to kind of interpret this, let's sit on a galaxy in our sample. That galaxy is, on average, sitting in a region of matter overdensity. So as we look out from that galaxy, there are an excess of galaxies determined by the correlation function as a function of scale. So I'm drawing contours of neighboring galaxies with the green. Now if I observe this this situation from the bottom of the page and include the velocity effect, these contours are squashed along the line of sight. In that objects that are on the other side of the galaxy are blue shifted towards us according to this equation, and objects on this side are redshifted. So we can measure the growth rate of structure just by quantifying how non-circular the contours are in galaxy clustering. The quantity that we measure, so we're basically getting a measure of the amplitude of the peculiar velocity field, which is the rate at which matter fluctuations sigma 8 are growing as a function of the scale factor of the universe. And for some reason, cosmologists like to write this way. So an overall amplitude of the matter fluctuations at the epoch of our galaxy survey times f. F is a logarithmic derivative of the growth rate, of sigma 8. And that's approximately equal to omega matter to gamma. Gamma is 0.55 in GR. Okay, so those are all the things we're going to try to measure. I think everyone in this room probably knows, but just in case you don't, measuring both the expansion rate and the growth history of the universe is an interesting venture. So in linear theory and general relativity, after we're well into the matter-dominated epoch, the power spectrum maintains the same shape as the function of time, and it only grows by this growth factor g in amplitude. That growth factor is specified by this equation, which depends only on how much matter there is in the universe and what the expansion history of the universe has been. And so once you have a measurement of the expansion history, you can ask if fluctuations have grown the way that you expect in GR. And this lets you look for all kinds of exotic things. Yes?
How much does doing this need to assume that sigma 8 is fixed by the CMD? Because that could be modified if there was like scale-dependent bias or something. So if like the scale amplitude, you think you would fix sigma 8 to go like a bunch of. Do you need to assume that in order to do this, in order to do the register space distortion? Do you need to assume that you know sigma 8?
It only in the sense that your nonlinear, how big your nonlinear corrections are, depend on the value of sigma 8. So that's kind of like a second order effect. I mean, the test is obviously more, if you didn't know sigma 8 at CMB time, then you can't measure how much growth there has been from redshift 1000 to the redshift of your galaxies. So making that comparison is part of what makes this test so powerful. But you can do the fitting in a way that doesn't depend explicitly on that. Lots of things, modified gravity, interactions in the dark sector, massive neutrinos can break either the scale independence of linear growth and or this relationship between expansion history and the growth of structure. Okay, so that's the physics that we want to measure. Let's now look at the observations. So I've worked for the last several years on the baryon oscillation spectroscopic survey, Sloan 3. Just to put this in perspective, for those of you familiar with Sloan, the yellow things in this plot are the main galaxies from Sloan. Red are the SDSS2 LRGs. And white is the map that we're making with LOSS. Our targets are divided into two classes, CMAS, which I'll spend almost all the talk talking about those, are at the higher redshift end. We cut the sample between redshift 0.43 and 0.7. The LOSI sample is meant to just fill in at low redshift, bring the Sloan 2 LRGs up to a higher number density, and they're living primarily between redshift 0.2 and 0.4. So BOSS, when it's done, which is will be within a month, hopefully, is going to map out 10,000 square degrees and add 1.35 million new redshifts. We published.
Sorry, what is the median redshift?
So we analyzed those two samples separately for now. The effective redshift, which is a pair-weighted quantity of the LOSI sample, is 0.32 and 0.57 for CMAS.
That's 1.35 million, that's both CMAS and LOSI? Or...
That's right. So most of them are CMAS. Okay, so this is a plot of the angular coverage that we had in DR9. That's now old news. We published a bunch of papers on that sample. The DR10 data has been public since July. This is its coverage. Most of the results I'm going to talk about today are based on DR11, which is 90% of the survey. This catalog is not yet public, but it will be in December, along with the final catalog, DR12. Okay, this is an animation that Daniel Eisenstein made that I really like. So this is a 53 degrees by 38 degree slice through the survey. What this plot is doing is moving through that slice as a function of redshift. Blue galaxies are in front and red are behind, and this is how the apparent size of the BAO standard ruler is changing as you move through the sample. So this is just kind of our raw data. You can see that the angular density as you're moving at the higher redshift is getting a lot higher. And that's where most of our signal noise comes from.
Are you also not plotting things that are too far from the
which far behind? Because intensity seems to change.
Yes, so I think there's a fixed thickness in delta z when you make this plot. Okay, so we in December and January we put out a slew of papers based on DR11. I obviously can't talk about all of them, so I'll mostly talk about our BAO results. That was an alphabetical paper, and the redshift space distortion results that I was most closely involved with. And that was led by Lado Samashia. Okay, so to kind of put everything I'm going to talk about into put some coherence there, I'm going to move from the least aggressive to the most aggressive means to extract information from BOSS. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is only information that comes from the signature of the baryonic acoustic oscillations in the clustering of galaxies. So we basically, as I was saying, marginalize over broadband terms in the clustering. And we also introduce reconstruction, which I'll define in a minute, and that boosts the signal to noise available from just the BAO feature. And our approach here marginalizes out also redshift space distortion information. And the claim is that this makes us very insensitive to the details of galaxy biasing and nonlinear evolution. So that's most conservative. Next, we'll actually try to use the full scale dependence of the clustering in psi of rp and rpi. And from there, we'll infer the angular diameter distance, the expansion rate, and the redshift space distortion parameter f sigma 8. And this becomes more sensitive to galaxy biasing and nonlinear evolution, so we introduce some nuisance parameters to describe our uncertainty in that relationship. And the last thing I'm going to talk about is something that I've been working on for the last year or so that tries to use very small scale information and to jointly fit something about cosmology and also the relationship between galaxies and dark matter. Okay, this animation was made by Nikhil Padmanabhan. So what the animation does is starts off with uniform initial conditions, and the initial distribution of black points is given by the width of the BAO feature inherent in the linear theory correlation function. So nonlinear gravitational evolution takes those black points and shifts them about, but it shifts them in a very predictable way. So regions where you have more matter over density, the black points are going to move in that direction. So points like here and here. And so the claim, or what reconstruction takes advantage of, is the fact that your galaxy field tells you how the galaxies have been displaced relative to their initial conditions. And so this black distribution right here that's fatter than the initial distribution is just the PDF of where the black points ended up after nonlinear gravitational evolution. So that decreases the signal to noise of your BAO. These blue points are the displacements, so directions and magnitudes of displacements of the black points that we can estimate directly from the density field. And so what reconstruction does is estimate this blue field and then move the points back to where they came from. And the point of that is to reconstruct the initial BAO peak.
Getting out the redshift space distortions with this pointing back?
Yes, so I mean there are... So in second order Lagrangian perturbation, or first order Lagrangian perturbation theory, the displacement of the objects caused by gravity is exactly the same vector that tells you what its velocity is. And so we just estimate this displacement field, and that tells us both, you know, that tells us how to move it back to the initial conditions, but it also tells us how to take out the redshift space distortions, I mean, to lowest order. So we will do both. So on large scales, if we basically know what the right normalization of the velocity field is, then the correlation function that we get after reconstruction will be isotropic. Okay, so now let's slowly move these points back. As we move them along their displacement vector, the width of the black ring of points is getting sharper again. And that illustrates how we increase the signal to noise on the BAO feature. But you can also see when this thing is done, I guess it's done now, we haven't, you know, we didn't go back to a homogeneous density field, right? We've just kind of corrected large-scale bulk motions. So you still see lots of, you know, filaments and such that come from nonlinear gravity. That's right. That looks a little bit worse. I don't know if it looks much worse than initially, but remember, we will also, when you calculate the correlation function, we're going to average over many, many centers. Okay, so how do we fit the BAO? We've already had some questions about this. So we start with a template that's just the linear matter power spectrum. The BAO feature is damped by nonlinear evolution. You can calculate that in linear perturbation theory. And so the mathematical way that we implement that fact is to divide the power spectrum into a smooth piece and a piece that contains the oscillations, and then damp with the Gaussian as a function of k, given by some nonlinear, by some damping scale. Okay, so damp the BAOs. We add some nuisance parameters that just describe kind of broadband behavior of the correlation function as a function of scale s. And then we fit a model that contains the BAO. So this alpha is shifting the template compared to the data and measuring the BAO scale with some arbitrary amplitude. That's depends on the galaxy bias. And marginalize over these nuisance parameters. That's the.
The nuisance parameters, are they cosmology or systematics?
They both. Everything.
So how do you learn that they're there? How did you get that shape if they are both systematics and cosmology?
The point of these functions should be sufficiently general that any kind of broadband effects are just absorbed, so that the only thing that is contributing to your constraint on alpha is where the BAO is. And so we do both power spectrum. I'm just writing here the correlation function, but we actually also fit the power spectrum, and that has like five of these rather than three. Okay, so. You may not like our choice of how we fit the BAO, so I would just say the proof is in the pudding. So we validated these models by a set of 600, I think, mock catalogs, where we do the same thing that we do to the data in all of these mocks. And so what this table is showing you is the mean alpha that we get. So we know the cosmology of the mocks, and so this number should be 1. It is 1 to 4 zeros. This is the error bar that we get, the mean error bar that we get from the mocks on our measurement of alpha. So 0.9%. So calculate a probability of alpha after you've marginalized over these nuisance parameters. And that gives you your estimate for each realization of what your uncertainty in alpha is. If you compare that to the scatter in the alphas from the mocks, those two things agree, which tells you that the way that we're estimating our error bars from p of alpha is not biased either. In detail, we do fits both to the correlation function and the power spectrum and combine them to give our kind of final answer. The other thing that you can see in this table is we also do fits without the reconstruction process. And you can see that fits to our mocks are biased compared to the truth at the 0.4% level, which you can actually compute and expect in perturbation theory. The BAO scale does shift. And so one of the nice things that reconstruction does, besides improve the error bar by almost a factor of two, is also take out this shift. Okay, we can also use the mocks to ask how typical is the result that we got. So here are our uncertainties in alpha when we fit before applying the technique of reconstruction. This is power spectrum and correlation function. And this is the error bar after. So this straight line tells you the case when the error bars are exactly the same, which means that reconstruction bought you absolutely nothing. And actually, in DR9, we were close to that case. We did reconstruction, but it didn't help. And so you can see in this case where we have a more contiguous part of the sky covered, in every case in the mocks, reconstruction actually lowers the uncertainty on alpha. And you can see that our measured uncertainties are consistent with these mocks. So this is just a plot that shows you the fits to the correlation function on the left, before reconstruction, after reconstruction, and this is the power spectrum. Now we can interpret those measurements of the BAO scale in cosmology. So now there are enough BAO measurements that we can build a distance ladder. So on the x-axis is redshift, and the y-axis is this dv, which I introduced. It's two parts dA, one part 1 over h, compared, normalized by our standard ruler BAO scale. So this is 60F. We made a measurement also with our Lozy example in this most recent paper, and this is our the CMAS, for which I just showed you the fits. Okay, so that's the measurements of the BAO distance scale as a function of redshift. If you take Planck's lambda CDM chain and just ask what does it predict for this observable, you get that gray band, which is quite impressive. Okay, so let's zoom in a little bit. Now I'm dividing those measurements by Planck's best fit. So Planck now lies along the line 1 in this plot. And the gray band says shows you what the uncertainty in this prediction is. And it's at high redshift, it's 1%. At low redshift, it's 2%. And that uncertainty is dominated by the uncertainty in the physical matter density. Okay, so that's Planck. If we instead fit, make that same prediction for WMAP combined with ACT and SPT, you get this gray band right here. So for some reason, the cosmic microwave background does not agree with itself. And again, it's dominated by the fact that their best fit physical matter densities are different. Unfortunately, BAO doesn't have much to say on which one is right. If you looked at the Planck papers, our DR9 point was like ridiculously exactly centered on the Planck measurement, but we have since come down a little bit. I guess so, yeah. It's because I'm David Spergel's student.
Or can I ask you, to what extent is the analysis done with an eye on other previous cosmic microwave background measurements or applying to them? To what extent are there choices being made in there?
That's an excellent question. So by no means do we do a blind analysis, but it's also extremely difficult to make the scale we measure move. At least in the galaxies, there's not a lot of wiggle room. Most of our systematics all of our systematics that we're aware of are very broad changes in power on large scales. the Lyman Alpha Forest actually, the Lyman Alpha Forest group has a lot, they also measure a BAO feature, and they have a lot more choices to make. So how they do continuum fitting, and you know, there's a million little things like that, how they mask.
You seem to have all those choices. You have a continuum that you want to fit, and you have mask, I assume. So
we have a mask. The continuum basically is just determined by the distribution of galaxies that we observe. I mean, we basically just so the mask, the angular mask, is just determined by where we observe objects and where we don't. And its completeness is almost equal to one. And then the selection function in the redshift direction, we just determine by the actual observed redshifts of the galaxies. So the procedure with which we measure a correlation function is basically generate randoms that are consistent with that angular distribution and their redshifts.
For continuum, I meant this broadband feature that you were talking about that you marginalized over. So I mean, that's essentially your version of the continuum that you don't care about, you want to marginalize over. And it seems that there's similar to what Lyman Alpha people.
Well, Lyman Alpha people also marginalize over the same process, but the continuum that I was talking about that Lyman Alpha people need to do is they need to measure the flux relative to what was emitted by the quasar. And that definition, I think, is much more subtle and difficult to make. That's right.
The systematics and the gastrophysics are getting much better models.
I agree with you. All I want to say is they make more choices, and so they actually tried to do a blind analysis in their first round.
What do you get for the fit of the matter power spectrum?
What is the?
This is the fit that I was seeing here. It's a smooth curve because there's no collision in the force of push for dark matter. The point is that if you reduce the amount of dark matter in the transfer function, which gives you the calculation for the power spectrum, and you begin to see oscillations, small k, what do you get?
Yes, I don't think I showed you a plot from 2010 of the of our estimate of the matter correlation function on relatively.
Before you transform from k,
there was one plot, which I'm happy to go back to if you want.
I think you showed the power spectrum here as well.
This is P of K. This is from 2010, but if I showed you the other one, you wouldn't see a lot of difference. So this subtle wiggles are actually the BAO in the model. And this is the, you know, this is the broadband.
But you need a lot of LRTs. You can begin to see structural oscillations for small k, but these are due to large redshift.
So John, they're seeing everything that they're supposed to see. So
okay, thank you.
They are seeing everything that they're supposed to see. They see the wiggles. They see at the right amplitude. So
all right, I'm happy to talk more later and show you some plots of the power spectrum.
I don't think you're seeing all your
Okay, let's just keep going here. So everything I just talked about was averaging over the orientation of pairs in this diagram to fit the BAO feature. Because we have enough signal to noise, we can actually fit two different geometric scale factors, one in this direction, dA, and the other in the H direction. So this orange contour shows you the constraints that we get on that in that joint space. And this is compared to the analysis I just showed you where you get some combination of dA and H. And this is the prediction from Planck and this from WMAP. Okay, so What do we learn from this? This is my best attempt to show you how these measurements constrain different cosmological parameters, namely the curvature of the universe, W and WA. So this is the redshift 0.57 constraint that I just showed you. This is what Planck and Lambda CDM predicts for that. This is at the central value of the physical matter density, and this, the uncertainty, the width of that prediction, it comes from the value of the physical matter density. So we center ourselves there and vary whatever parameter we want, omega k, w, wa, but fixing the distance to the last scattering surface, this is how the best fit Planck cosmology shifts as you explore that one parameter space. So what I want you to read from this is that none of these parameters actually move you closer to our best fit values of dA and h. The other thing that doing this anisotropic analysis buys you is that the constraint on dA gets slightly better if you project onto this axis, and that translates into slightly better constraints on different cosmological models. So our observed dA times h is about 1.5 sigma high compared to most any sensible model, basically, you can build for the expansion history. This is the constraint from the BAO feature on the low Z sample. The fact that this thing is fatter means that our constraint is less good. But the spacing between these points also indicates that the sensitivity to W, for instance, is better in the low Z sample. And so both of them contain cosmological information when we go to fit cosmology. Okay, so in this plot, I'm showing you constraints on omega m and h naught, either using WMAP as a CMB or Planck, but we've combined the BAO measurements with supernova. And what that gives you is kind of an absolute calibration of the distance scale at low redshift from the BAO, and the supernova bring that calibration down to redshift zero. And so what you can see is that in Lambda CDM, that gives you a percent level constraint on H naught. Omega M is 0.31. And if we let the low redshift cosmology vary by adding curvature, W naught, and WA, the center of these constraints stay the same. Their uncertainties get larger, though. How much time do I have?
How much time?
10 till?
Yeah.
Okay, let's speed up a little bit. Okay, so you can also project this into constraints on omega k. We get a constraint of 0.003 on omega k, and basically we don't see any difference from Lambda CDM. Okay, now adding information from retrospace distortions, just as motivation, RSD in the Dark Energy Task Force third edition, RSD are pointed out to be among the most powerful ways of addressing whether acceleration is caused by dark energy or modified gravity. So the way that we're going to extract that information is to measure multipoles of the correlation function. This is the monopole, which has the same BAO feature that I showed you before. And the anisotropy is measured by the second multipole moment. It's negative because those contours are squashed relative to in this direction, basically. Okay? The blue curve is the monopole of the correlation function. And the red, so the points are the measurements. Blue and red are best fit values. Best fit models. And you should remember that points in the correlation function are correlated together. And so the model is kind of allowed to move up and down at some level without changing chi-squared very much. I don't have a plot. It becomes rather isotropic on large scales, but it, on small scales, it's still anisotropic. It basically doesn't fix fingers of God and so on. It makes an approximation that the velocities of objects are the linear theory values, which is not correct on small scales.
Would it be correct to say that the construction is working perfectly? It would get rid of the large scale linear anisotropy completely. Is that
the large scale what?
The large scale anisotropy.
Yes, but you have to make a choice. You have to basically know what the amplitude of the velocity field is in order to do it. So you could also imagine saying, I'm going to do reconstruction as a function of what the F sigma 8 is, basically, and the value that would make the correlation function the most isotropic would be the value, the actual value of F sigma 8. If that were the correct, you know, absolutely the correct model of the correlation function, that would be a perfectly reasonable thing to do. In this case, we haven't done that. So now we are not doing reconstruction. We're just fitting the observed correlation function.
So, question. So your chi-squared is rather low compared to the degrees of freedom. So is that, how do you interpret that?
If you just ask how often might I get 18 out of 27, it's not unreasonable. So I. Okay. Yeah. So I don't have very much time, but I will just say so in order to extract redshift space distortion information, now we need a model. For what the monopole and the quadrupole look like as a function of scale. The blue shows you just the naive linear theory Kaiser prediction, and the red shows you the model that we use that basically has nonlinear corrections both for biasing and the fact that the velocity field has important nonlinear corrections.
Are those measurement errors
or? These are simulations. This is basically telling you that on a set of simulations, this model works well. Okay, and what goes into the model, assuming that you know what the geometry is, and we know the scale dependence of the correlation function from the CMB, then all we do is basically fit two amplitudes, the amplitude of the monopole and the quadrupole. And that lets us, we can infer from those two amplitudes the bias times the overall amplitude of matter fluctuations and this F sigma 8 parameter that we're interested in. And we need to add some nuisance parameters that describe the relation.
So these come from linear theory, don't they? Or these functions, psi
naught and psi 2? Blue is what linear theory will tell you.
And then there's nonlinear. So what is the pressure of perturbation theory? Or?
Yes, this is based on perturbation theory. I'm happy to give you all the details if you want, but it's a little bit complicated.
I'm just wondering why you don't just do, the same idea with CMB, you just don't fit. But just fit the whole thing instead of parameterizing in terms of two parameters.
You mean fit jointly at the same time for basically the power spectrum shape?
Yeah.
You can do that, but we don't actually have a huge range of scales here. So actually one of the papers of DR11 tries to do this, Chuang et al, but we don't actually have good constraints jointly on that whole function because the range of scales that we observe well and is not in the nonlinear regime is relatively small.
Don't show the view of future in the quadrupole, is that?
Say again?
If I'm interpreting this plot correctly, then the simulations don't show the VA of future in the quadrupole.
That's right, yeah. That's a fact about nonlinear evolution. So in fact, our theory on these scales is that, yeah, from here up is simply Lagrangian perturbation theory. So that predicts what happens to the quadrupole really accurately.
I thought you were saying that you could measure VA times H from the VA of quadrupole of beta.
Next plot. Okay, so if I change this Alcock-Pachinsky parameter at fixed dV, then the quadrupole stays exactly the same. The monopole stays exactly the same, and the quadrupole, so this is dA times h fixed at the value of the simulations, and then plus or minus 10%. So it changes both the amplitude of the quadrupole and also changes if you kind of measure a slope on these scales, that's different. And then you also get bleed BAO signature into the quadrupole. And so the fact that if we don't see these, then that puts some limit on the correctness, basically, of our fiducial cosmology, if that makes sense. So if you change the Alcock-Pachinsky parameter, you will see BAO features in the quadrupole. And that's where their constraints are coming from. OK. So under this assumption where we take the scale dependence from Planck, as Niyash was putting out, we then can just extract three parameters. We get f sigma 8, this Alcock-Pachinsky parameter, dA times h, and dV, all at the same time. And they have some covariance between them. So the red shows our fits. Blue tells you what Planck predicts. They are consistent. So one kind of cosmology application of these fits is that, oops, there should be a negative here, is that we actually do a little bit better on constraining W. So here I'm comparing apples to apples, just taking the fits on dA, h, and f sigma 8 from the previous slide, fitting those in a cosmology where W is free. And I'm comparing that to the BAO. That's right. Yes. Okay. So what I want to say, okay, they're both consistent with minus one, but this error bar is smaller. And if you look at the raw errors on our f sigma 8, you think that is very weird. So this is my best attempt to explain why adding growth information helps you to constrain dark energy. So the red curve, this is from DR9, but it's still conceptually the same. Measuring the amplitude of the quadrupole basically gives you a joint constraint on growth of structure and the Alcock-Pachinsky parameter that looks like this red thing. And if you ask, where in the space do you move when you introduce the parameter W? Given constraints from the cosmic microwave background and the isotropic measurement of the BAO, so dV over RS, you move in along this blue contour. So in this corner, W is more negative. So what does that do? That lowers the angular diameter distance to the redshift of our sample. So it puts this Alcock-Pachinsky parameter down. And more negative W also means that structure grows more between redshifts of 1,000 and redshift of 0.57. And so it just turns out that the thing that we measure with the quadrupole has a nice complementarity to the isotropic BAO plus the CMB for this in this case. You can also measure, parameterize the growth in this way and measure this parameter gamma. It's consistent with GR, but maybe not a very interesting constraint yet. I think I should probably stop. Is it noon-ish? Okay. So I'll just kind of mention these other things that I'm interested in and working on in case you want to talk about them in more detail. I've been fitting retrospace distortions on very small scales with a joint model that includes details of how galaxies occupy dark matter halos and also on what the overall amplitude of the peculiar velocity field is. So just in comparison to this diagram, we're now just zooming into this red part. But I will save that for personal discussions. Okay? Sure.
I'd like to see what you're going to tell us about modified growth.
Okay, thank you. That's the question I was looking for. So I'm going to use the Halo model. You know what that is? Okay, great. This plot is just trying to tell you what physics enters the small scale clustering in redshift space. So one way to think about the observed correlation function in redshift space is that it's a convolution of the real space correlation function. This is the number of pairs you have at a given real space separation. And you convolve it with the probability distribution of the difference in velocity between two pairs. Make sense? Okay. So the real space things that you care about for modeling the redshift space correlation function are the real space clustering. So that's shown on the left. And what the relative velocity of galaxies or halos are as a function of scale. So in this plot, green is a slightly more highly biased halo sample. So the correlation function is larger. And this function is just what is the relative velocity of halos as a function of their separation, real space separation here. So more massive halos are falling together faster. The units of this plot are switched to distances, which just says, like, if they're separated by 5 megaparsecs, but they have an infall velocity of 3 megaparsecs, then I will observe them to be separated by 2 megaparsecs. Okay, so that's just what this looks like as a function of scale. There was a paper just recently, first author is Zhu, that makes predictions, or that studies what these functions look like as a function of scale in F of R and Galilean simulations. And Elise Jennings was on there, David Weinberg, and a few more people. Just kind of a generic feature that they observed is that this infall velocity at 5 megaparsecs was larger by a factor, by 1 to 2, I converted units for you. So 1 to 2 H inverse megaparsecs. So this is, you know, almost a 30% change. I only have 2 more slides, so bear with me. So the measurements that we're going to fit are the projected correlation function. This is WP, if you've ever listened to someone talk about the halo model. So pairs smaller than about 1 megaparsec are two galaxies that are sitting in the same dark matter halo. And on larger scales, these are pairs sitting in different dark matter halos. That's where the transition happens. And in WP, you can actually see a break in the power law at that scale. This is the monopole and quadrupole on very small scales. So this is separations from less than 1 megaparsec out to 30. So I was just showing you that typically halos in our sample are falling together at 3 megaparsecs-ish. And there's also a width to that velocity distribution. And so scales kind of below 4 megaparsecs in this diagram showing monopole and quadrupole down here, you get information basically about the velocity structure. And the value of S doesn't really map to the actual separations, right? It's more about what the velocity distribution looks like on small scales. On larger scales, you are closer to the limit where real space separation and redshift space separation are closer together. Okay, and so this thing goes from, the quadrupole goes from positive when the velocities are kind of making things appear to be farther apart than they are in real space, to negative on larger scales. Okay, this is a fit using the halo model where we're varying. The fit is based on a simulation, but we can actually vary the overall amplitude of the peculiar velocity field of the halos. So that's where our cosmology constraint comes from. And so this is kind of the ugliest money plot in history, I call it. So this is the prediction from Planck for what this should be at the redshift of our sample. So it's 0.48 plus or minus 0.01. This green thing is what we measured the results I just showed you on large scales. It's centered at about 0.45. And our joint fits to the small scale clustering give, if you kind of put them all together, you get this red curve. The reason why this is so ugly is because our theory is being generated from simulations, and so there's actually uncertainty in the theoretical calculation. But we've done this with four different simulations, and we get basically consistent results. And so the measurement that we get is that the growth rate at redshift 0.57 is 0.45 plus or minus 0.011. Okay, that's what I was going to say. Thank you for asking.
I guess we should finish that, and we should run a bit over time. But before we run back again, just as usual, we will be having dinner with Beth in the bistro this evening at 6 o'clock, and post up to the students. We'll be paid for, and everyone else is welcome to join if you want to. So,
thanks.